wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
47 stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message breakup. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen, the camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson abandoned babies.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plans to see? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who does it speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's at the door, and that's what entertainment's for. It's a drug of the century, the soul penitentiary.
Did you find your loss of virginity?
Well, the song News Goo by Polarity One. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on Media Channel Radio. Each week, talking with people in the media and talking about media issues. Joining me today, I'm very pleased to announce that Paul Jay, I guess the founder, bottle washer, executive producer, and visionary behind the Real News Network in Baltimore, Maryland now, and with a exciting development coming up later this month to tell us about, is joining me to talk about his actual transition from being a corporate or at least a public television executive in a much more establishment organization to actually launching a global Real News Network online and having tremendous success all around the world with people who are accessing it. So thank you very much, Paul Jay, for joining me.
Thanks very much, Danny.
Paul, tell us a little bit, for those who don't know, about Real News Network, TRNN, the Real News Network. Tell us about the inspiration for it, how you envisioned it, and why you, in a sense, left a very, established and respected career in Canada to launch this new venture.
I guess it really started after 9/11 with what became a kind of collapse of what was left of any kind of real television news in the United States, and to some extent Canada as well. The Dan Rather told the BBC, says, sometime around 2004, 2005, that if you critique the White House, it was akin to being a traitor in a South African township and having a flaming tire of patriotism put around your neck. Unfortunately, Rather only said that to the BBC, to say it here in the United States, where it might have had more effect. But
here he said, let's not forget, to President Bush, tell me what to do, I'm there with you, you know, initially,
yeah, exactly.
If we recall. But I think on reflection, he realized and was willing to at least speak out about, if not in our country, about the way in which the media basically got in line with the government.
Yeah. So at the time, I was producing the main political debate show in Canada on CBC, CBC's news channel, a show called Counterspin. And we were an actually independent production. I never have worked directly for CBC, but we shot the show in CBC. We were the only actual independent production doing daily news, current affairs programming. We were doing the real debate for when a few days after 9/11, newspapers in much of the English-speaking world had articles saying that if you tried to connect 9/11 attacks to U.S. foreign policy, if you tried to suggest there's something such as blowback, you're capitulating to terrorism and you're blaming the victims. Well, we did that debate. What was U.S. foreign policy? What really created the soil for this kind of extremism? And we kept doing the debate, including the Afghan war, the Iraq war. But the kind of debate we were having on that show, and we were able to get away with it in Canada at the time, partly because, for a lot of reasons I won't go into right now, Canada didn't get into the Iraq War. But none of that debate was on any kind of television, perhaps Democracy Now!, but nothing else in the United States. And we saw the need for...
Let me just jump in here for one second, because, you know, you're telling us this story on the very day that the 9/11 Museum... opened with a big ceremony here in New York, Rudy Giuliani and President Obama speaking down at Ground Zero, all the images shown once again of the planes hitting the tower and all the, you know, what they found in the towers that are now exhibits in this museum. And, you know, however, no deeper issues about the 9/11 experience, no real reflections were shared other than, you know, the sorrow that many of us feel with for the people who died and the anger that most Americans still feel at the people who they think did this to us. Interestingly enough, next week, next weekend, the 9/11 Truth Museum is opening up down at Ground Zero. So the debate about 9/11, you know, is at least going to continue in some form, because now that it's become history, although it still informs and is still really the driver of a lot of the surveillance going on in America and the direction our foreign policy has taken and is taking.
Yeah, so we could see it as from 9/11 through the Afghan war into the Iraq war, what was essentially a complete capitulation by American television news. And at the same time, a tremendous opportunity to create an alternative. The internet, obviously, in terms of fundraising, in terms of video distribution, getting around the gatekeepers of cable television, in terms of interactivity. Now there was the potential to launch something that could create a new model, and the fundamental issue was to create a new economic model, which was something that would provide real independence. So our model from the beginning was no government funding, no corporate funding, and we don't sell advertising. And it meant we were really independent. Also, we were independent of the political parties. We were not an appendage of or the left wing of or some kind of section of the Democratic Party. And that was an important principle right from the beginning. And when we started broadcasting in 2007, webcasting in 2007, we were as critical of the Democratic Party and President Obama as we were, or then candidate Obama, as we were of the Republicans. And it actually probably hurt us in terms of fundraising, because there was such an enormous push to try to elect President Obama, and his fundraising machine was enormous. But it goes to the very core of who we are, that we're trying to seek truth. And when President Obama had a fight with Reverend Wright, we did a story, was Reverend Wright wrong? And the conclusion of that story is he wasn't wrong, because the Wright's position was there was blowback, and it had a lot to do with why there were 9/11 attacks. And clearly that's true. And Wright saying there's still systemic racism, which President Obama, or candidate Obama, tried to refute, and clearly Wright was wrong. Wright was right about that. At any rate, the origins or the inspiration was that mainstream media had totally become a propaganda organization, and that there was also now the opportunity to break the monopoly. And it was essential to break the monopoly on daily news, that's where people form their first opinions about stories, and the repetition of daily news reinforces people's or creates a worldview. And if you want people to get engaged in finding solutions, which is what we're about, we're not trying to just create news to be consumed. And we're not just, when we say get engaged and involved in solutions, we also recognize, and it's the most obvious thing there is about American society, but no one wants to talk about it, at least not in the news, is we live in a class society. So you have to decide, who are you broadcasting to? And Bloomberg and Financial Times and those kinds of newspapers, they're very clear on that question. You know, they're speaking to the investor class. So we're pretty clear about who we're mostly interested in, and that's ordinary people. And when we say people need to get engaged in finding solutions, and the news we do should facilitate that, we know who we're talking about and talking to. So the inspiration was that, and we've been working at it since about 2007.
Let me jump in here and just acknowledge that, first of all, I found the proposed Real News Network a very exciting project. I endorsed it along with many prominent people in independent and alternative media here in New York and around the world, actually, wishing this project well. But, you know, it's a very ambitious idea. media, Paul, man, I'm sure a lot of people tried to argue you out of it. You know, you're dealing with and competing with media companies, you know, that are have billions of dollars invested in them, are tied into cable outfits, tied into all kinds of promotional machines. And here you are, in a sense, trying to create a news network that challenges all of them with a different angle on things, but without very much money behind you. Was that crazy in retrospect, or are you feeling like it was worthwhile taking the leap?
I think we learned something very, very important, and it took us a few years to learn it, but by about 2010, 2011, we understood it, and we've been heading in this direction since. Nationally, it's almost impossible to compete with the big media companies. Where there's great vulnerability, I would say, and where there's great opportunity is locally. Local news is awful, and it's weak, and people hate it. Our headquarters is based in Baltimore, and people despise local television news here, especially, you know, the majority of Baltimore, 64-65%, is black. But the majority, if you include the county, Baltimore County, of the television market is white, and that's who they talk to, because that's where they sell advertising, and that's where the money is. So there's a lot of cities like this right across the country where there's a tremendous opportunity to break through to a mass audience if you focus on the city, and it doesn't require anywhere near the kind of funding that it would require to try to make a dent nationally. On the other hand, if we can break through, like I think we can actually, within 3 to 5 years, we can be the mainstream media of Baltimore. And if we can do something similar in a city like Oakland or Detroit, New Orleans, and maybe further on gaining strength, places like Philadelphia, and then maybe you start to approach a place like Chicago, there's where the breakthroughs are going to become. And then you start to have a national footprint. But the Baltimore move for us is really the most important move, and you can say pilot project that we've done.
Well, I visited your headquarters there, and you're having a big opening ceremony in Baltimore, and I was very impressed. I mean, you've taken a building, you've created studios, you've aligned yourselves with community organizations, you have practically have a school going there for organizers and for people to talk about the issues of the news. In other words, this is not just a kind of a platform for professionals the best hair on the air, and I don't mean that in personal terms, Paul, okay? But this is a model, in a way, for how to energize the desire of so many people to really find out what's going on in their world as well as the world.
Yeah, I think it really hit, like, around 2010 or so. It was a bit of a turning point, and you can almost say a cathartic moment, because I was getting kind of fed up with the idea of, you know, do we just keep throwing more information out into the sea? This enormous, vast sea of internet information and broadcast information. Like, so what? I mean, even if you take some of the biggest things that broke, like Manning's revelations and Snowden's revelations, as big as those things were, and as much as those stories broke through, did anything change?
Well,
has America really changed as a result of it? And, I, you know, maybe you can say a little. People understand the surveillance state a little more. People, you know, they get some of the atrocities that took place in Iraq. It helps dispel if there were some illusions about what the Iraq War really was about. But what's clear is political change in this country is going to come because ordinary people wake up and fight for their interests. So we had to face the question, who are we doing news for? Are we just doing it so the people that are already sort of into the intelligentsia and the chattering classes and so on, so that they can understand more? I mean, a lot of people get off on the issue of analysis. They like to hear analysis. They want to be informed. But it doesn't change anything about how they lead their lives.
Well, you know, it's interesting about news and Baltimore, because, you know, I also worked as a community organizer in East Baltimore during the civil rights movement days there, and was really exposed to, you know, an incredibly poor community, which, you know, 50 years later is still an incredibly poor community, which has been undercovered by the media in Baltimore. And it's very interesting how an editor of the Baltimore Sun became got into dramatic television, created the series The Wire, which was not a news show, and yet it had news about a people and a world that was not being covered. It went beyond and beneath what news covers. And it did it in a way basically showcasing the drug world and the crime world and all the rest of it. But it seems as if it's also possible to get into what people are actually trying to do to make change in their own lives and try
to educate
themselves.
Yeah, because yeah, what really hit me at some point, we were doing a story, something to do with poverty or something or another, and I was talking to people here in Baltimore. And there's this sort of feeling that we need to, like, expose how bad the system is and expose how bad the problems are. But people here know all that. And they don't need anyone to tell them how screwed up things are. They know very well. What they don't have is a vision of an alternative. What is something that people can fight for that would actually solve the situation? And that's really what started leading to this Baltimore project.
One of the things, though, you're doing on that, Paul, that intrigues me, and it's really very unique and different from a lot of the news on alternative media, from Democracy Now! To many other outlets, is that you're actually going into the personal and the political. You're talking to people who are well known in the activist world, and you're really exploring with them how they became the political players that they became. Why? What motivated them? What were their families like? What were their, you know, political backgrounds? This is a Reality Asserts Itself, a series that the Real News Network has been doing. And these are not, you know, quick soundbite. I myself, you know, was down there and part of a really grueling conversation with you, in which you took no prisoners. I mean, you raised really deep questions. You were critical. You were challenging. And I think the net result of it was really interesting in a way that even left media, you know, which tends to get a little predictable. You know, we know who the bad guys are and we keep on bashing them, but you don't really get into who the potential good guys are and where they came from. Tell us about what led you to do that and what your experience with it has been.
Well, the reaction has been sensational, and I'm doing it for a few reasons. But one of the reasons we start the series very personally, and much of the series is woven about how does anywhere, you know, whether it's a Chris Hedges or a Ralph Nader or Phyllis Bennis or a Danny Schechter, it's partly that when one talks personally to begin with, you kind of open up. And it makes the whole rest of the conversation, when you deal with issues, much more creative and imaginative, and people are thinking in the moment rather than kind of saying things they've already thought about. But there's an even more important reason for doing it. I think all over the city, Baltimore, and all over the country, and I should say all over the world, in the sense that probably 40%, 35% of our viewers are not in the United States, and anywhere from, you know, Brazil to Germany to Nigeria. But all over the world, there are people who kind of have woken up about more of the reality of things, and they feel isolated. And they feel like, geez, am I thinking these things, but is anybody else? And when you can humanize people who have come to these conclusions and become activists or journalists, but willing to fight, willing to try to seek truth no matter what, when people can connect with the humanity of people doing that, they start to think, well, geez, I could do it too. Because if you're just talking politics all the time, and it's just categories of information.
Yeah, but but the biography of people's lives and their reflections on who influenced them. What was it like growing up in a working class family? What was it growing up in a wealthy family? Okay, what perceptions of the world did you have? How did you become, the person you are today? I think that's a really interesting way into people thinking about their own lives that way as well.
Exactly.
And it flies in the face of a lot of conventional media attitudes, i.e. people are not interested, keep it simple and stupid, talk down to the audience, don't introduce ideas that people are not already familiar with, and all the rest of it, the cliches and the conventional wisdom of news presentation. And you're actually standing that on its head, at least in that feature, in a way that's very fresh and different. I think it's gutsy to do it. I mean, I'm sure that there are people who've told you, well, why are you wasting so much time in this sort of thing?
Well, there were people in the real news, a lot of people were a little dubious of doing 20-minute segments on the web. But I just said, listen, let's just do what we believe in. Let's just do what's needed to really get at some core of the truth of this. And let's see how people react. And it's been amongst our most popular stuff. The issue, I mean, what you're saying is the reaction we're really getting universally.
See, what I like about it is it's, whether it's good or bad, it's reinvention. It's not just getting into what so much media gets into, which I feel I get into too sometimes, formula, being predictable, going for the people who, I agree with as opposed to people who I find more challenging. I mean, we on this, we for example, did an interview with David Carr at the New York Times, And, he really didn't share my criticisms, deeper criticisms of the New York Times. But he's a very feisty and interesting person who lived on welfare, who had a different biography and background, who brought to his work some years of experience in independent newspapers and alternative press. And so he came at the media not with, a sort of a desire to please the people on top, but a willingness to question them. And I was very impressed by that fire in his belly. And I think you have found a lot of people with fire in their bellies, and you have fire in your belly. Where did that come from?
I don't know. It's some combination of DNA and life experience. And I don't know, somewhere along the line, I guess fairly early on in my life, I realized if I'm not doing the most meaningful thing I can do, I'm not very happy. And I decided, well, I'm just going to follow that and come what may.
Well, I mean, it's also gutsy, Paul. Maybe I'm overplaying this because, I was one of those northerners who came to Baltimore when it really felt a lot more like a southern city than it probably feels today. With a group of people in the civil rights movement who were, perceived as, kind of out of towners, outside agitators and the like. And, for you to, kind of set down kind of roots in Baltimore and working with a very diverse group of people internationally, racially, I'm sure, in terms of sexual preference and everything else, and to be accepted and be able to actually create something that's successful, it's very hard. The left is littered, progressive media is littered with the same problems that the left itself has been littered with, splits, and people can't get along and can't find a common basis for working together. So that's a challenge in itself.
Yeah, maybe it was partly having come from working in mainstream media, even though we were independent. But we didn't approach this as any kind of left-wing project. We approached it as a professional media project. And so I think that actually helped us avoid some of the stuff that has happened to Pacifica and a lot of other organizations. But I find being in Baltimore a tremendous privilege, frankly. I love the city and I love the people. And what we're doing here is just so exciting. you know, we're doing a restaurant cafe called Jacob's Ladder, which is going to become a social hub for everyone that wants to change the world and come down and meet each other and eat, and we're going to have performance space there. We're doing investigative journalism where we're going to try to answer the question, what would you do if you ran Maryland and Baltimore in the interest of the majority of its people? And then we're going to have one of our studios seats 125 people. It's really, it's one of the bigger studios in the Baltimore, Washington area. And we're all set up for live streaming. So we're going to do live stream weekly town hall discussions and debates. For example, how do you have a safer city? How do you fix the public school system? What do you do with all the boarded up houses? And we're always going to connect big national, international things to what's happening in Baltimore. Because one of the things wrong with local news is it approaches things as if it's disconnected from the planet. And we're going to make those connections. You can't even talk about boarded up housing without talking about predatory lending and talking about the role of the financial sector and so on and so on. So we hope out of all this comes a vision of what you would do if you had a government interested in the majority of the people.
You know, 50 years ago, Paul, when I was this community organizer in East Baltimore, we went out into the streets and talked to kids about what was the racism and segregation mean to them? What were they concerned about? And what, to our surprise, many of these kids said, we're unhappy with the Buddy Dean Show, which was an afternoon dance program on Baltimore television, which, you know, once every 2 weeks, let black students and black young people come in and dance on the air. And this became a major program. It was like American Bandstand, but on a local level in Baltimore. And our group, which was called Bayou, the Baltimore Area Youth Opportunities Unlimited of the Northern Student Movement, rallied, you know, tutors that we were working with who were tutoring kids and the kids and interracially broke down the barriers on the air live in Baltimore, created a tremendous sensation. I was there, others were there challenging the Baltimore TV station, and we were denounced by the then Baltimore County executive, Spiro T. Agnew, who became the vice president of the United States under Richard Nixon until he was forced out because of his own corruption scandal. But we were in Baltimore, and that issue later led to the movie Hairspray, which I'm sure everybody knows about, but they don't know what triggered the interest in Hairspray and what the issues were. And it was probably the only dance-in in the civil rights movement, you know, where we had sit-ins, but this was a dance-in of people challenging the way they were being portrayed on television and excluded, and their voices and their dance steps and their energy was being excluded. And this was an extremely popular action, which of course history forgot. The local press didn't really cover, except for the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper, the black newspaper then in Baltimore. But it was a great event and led to this movie and Broadway show and two movies, etc. and so forth. But it shows you, you know, politics is thinking and speaking and acting locally, not just globally. And the two do link up, but I think what you're doing there is to make that connection come alive again, and with hip-hop shows and what have you.
Yeah, we're going to have a big cultural component here. We're developing a site called Independent World Music, which is going to be a platform for global, socially conscious, politically conscious hip-hop, but it's going to be nurtured, run, led from hip-hop artists from Baltimore. We're going to have regular streaming of live hip-hop shows from our studio. And one of the new shows we're developing for next year is our version of American Idol or something like that, or I should say The Voice, because instead of a singing competition, it's going to be a slam poet competition. There's 13 poetry teams in Baltimore, and that's going to become the basis of the show. But there's nationally hundreds of poetry teams from across the country. So it's going to be a weekly show, a poetry competition with probably even viewers voting and the whole sort of thing. But the themes are going to be social and political themes that the poets take up.
You know, again, what seems to be really important is to demonstrate another way of doing things. And if you can do that at a local level, if you can do that with the kind of pizzazz that the Real News Network brings to its work, I think it will inspire people to emulate you and to do something similar in other parts of the country. And that's where the local initiative could become a national initiative, even a global initiative.
Yeah, well, we want to do this. We want Real News, you could say, bureaus, chapters, you know, all over the country. So we hope this does spread.
So this is a way of media change, actually starting with what the media does best, which is communicate, which is inform, which is inspire, which is educate. And that's what's exciting to me about it. Paul, can you stay with us? We're going to come back in a few minutes. We just have to take a break now. Is that okay?
Okay, sure.
All right.
Okay.
Paul Jay on Media Channel Radio. Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on Media Channel Radio, back with Paul Jay of the Real News Network in Baltimore, Maryland, where, you know, Real News Network can actually be seen from the highway of people going through on the way to Washington or other parts of Maryland, and is becoming a presence there as an independent media organization that not only tries to take on national and international stories, but is also taking on local initiatives. When you look at the stories in the news today, what is the stories that you think are missing the most?
Oh, well, I guess what I said earlier, for most people, international news is completely an abstraction. National stories are mostly off their radar. I think for most people, and I mean most people, I mean people who are not university educated, who are not tied into the kind of spectrum of information that read the New York Times every day, that are online looking at news and so on and so on. Most people, life is about their direct experience. And that's why local matters so much, because direct experience is very much about your city, where you work and so on, or go to school, where you live. Which means it's also because for most people, life is a day-to-day struggle. People live paycheck to paycheck. They often have to have two jobs. Often, if their parents, their kids are having terrible troubles. We know it's at this level of looking at American life that you really see, you know, what mass incarceration means. You know, if you want to see class struggle, go to a jail. Jail, of course, but I mean, go to a courtroom, you know, where you see mostly white judges and mostly white lawyers, and in Baltimore, 99% black people who have been charged with crimes, many for just crazy minor things. What's missing, and this is what we're trying to do, is news stories that help people understand the social, political, economic context of why they're in this situation, and most importantly, what they can do about it. And so that's the most important thing that's missing. Now, you could, of course, on international stories, you know, the Ukraine, if you want, for an example, mainstream media gives you as much a propaganda version of what's happening in Ukraine as RT and, you know, the Russians give a propaganda version of their take on Ukraine. What we do when we talk about Ukraine, we talk about a battle between Russian, Ukrainian, and American and German oligarchs. There's a struggle going on, and the Ukrainian people are caught in the middle of this struggle of oligarchs. If we do a story on Nigeria, we try to understand the reasons Nigeria is in such chaos, and obviously, you know, it goes back to the nurturing of military dictatorships and the role of Western oil companies. We're always trying to, you know, give a more realistic, bigger picture, and of course that kind of context, especially historical context, is always missing in the majority of mainstream coverage of everything.
Well, in Baltimore, for example, one of the early documentaries on the financial crisis, before it was even recognized as a financial crisis, had to do with the subprime lending, the rule of I'm not sure which bank it was in Baltimore.
Well, Wells Fargo.
Wells Fargo Bank, okay, which actually had in its documents, you know, talked about the mud people of Baltimore. That's how they referred to black Americans who they were kind of soliciting to take on these completely unfair loans.
Is this a documentary of yours, Danny?
No, it wasn't mine. It was a film that some people I know made, and it was a really important start to really looking at this subprime
Yeah, I mean, Baltimore is the home of the subprime mortgage.
So, I know you know that. I just wanted everybody listening to know
that.
Yeah,
well, most people in Baltimore don't know that.
So if you look at society and at the world from the bottom up, you've got to ask yourself, what happened to the black middle class that was emerging in Baltimore, the people who wanted better homes, wanted better schools for their children, and who end up getting caught up in this criminal enterprise? I mean, the subprime lending was not just a mistake. It wasn't just something that was done, kind of accidentally. It was done with a lot of forethought to try to squeeze people and get as much money out of them, at least the people who were least able to afford it.
And Baltimore, yeah, it was completely targeted at African Americans. And one of my critiques of The Wire, although there's no question The Wire is one of the best television series ever produced, but in the year 2000, the number one cause of foreclosures in Baltimore was subprime mortgages. Year 2000, many of the boarded up houses that you see, that's the backstory of those boarded up houses, and that whole kind of very deliberate targeting, as you say, and there's a long history of block busting in Baltimore, where they deliberately would break up neighborhoods with the hope of once a neighborhood got so bad, people would leave, and then you could gentrify. And there was this drug culture that people saw on The Wire. That wasn't an accident. It's also, to a large extent, the result of deliberate policies. Maybe not deliberate policies to have drug wars and such, but to some extent, some people suggested actually was even that. That people knew that, for example, if banks stopped giving loans for people to repair their houses, which is what happened, when house after house starts to deteriorate, then drug culture naturally starts to develop.
There goes the neighborhood. One of the stories that I did when I worked at 2020 at ABC News, that I sort of got into and became very proud of, was what happened to the Baltimore Colts football team in Baltimore. This is before the Ravens. You know, the Baltimore Colts were a distinguished team. They were a team that was loved in Baltimore, kind of a working class, Johnny Unitas, a team that Baltimore loved. And it was just one day, this guy, from Indianapolis came in, bought the team, and moved it. With no debate, no discussion, and the town lost a source of tremendous pride, and it was just done in the interest of how, big sports got bigger, and didn't really care about the communities in which the sports culture had emerged. So that was this Baltimore story that I did that I was, which also was a way in which something that happened in Baltimore later rippled out into the rest of America. I mean, this business with the Clippers and all the rest of it has resonance, of some of this. And of course, Baltimore as a town, as a sports town, as a kind of suburb, if you will, of Washington, D.C., has always been sort of neglected in terms of, what its needs are and what's happening there and the incredible mix of people who live there.
Yeah, I mean, it's also important that, I'm not sure everybody knows, Maryland is an extremely wealthy state. In fact, Maryland has more millionaires than any other state in the country, more than New York, apparently. There's more billionaires in New York, but apparently there's more multimillionaires in Maryland. And Maryland is in the top 10 states in the United States with the greatest income inequality.
Well, if any of those millionaires are listening, I hope they'll consider supporting the Real News Network in Baltimore, because it would be a good investment into trying to turn things around in that community. You know, I mean, of course, but, you know, when you hear about Baltimore, what do you hear about? Johns Hopkins, the hospital there, you know, which is on the cutting edge of all kinds of big research. And meanwhile, the community around it is suffering.
Right now there's a struggle going on at Hopkins. Cleaning the service workers, cleaners, maintenance, that sort of thing. The starting salary is, if I remember correctly, just over $10 an hour. And there are many of the workers, and these are people who clean surgical rooms, who have to deal with bloody sheets and picking up, you know, the results of surgery off the floor and so on. They have people who have been working 15 years that are only making $14.21 an hour. And what they're asking for is a $15 wage starting in 2015. And Hopkins so far is completely refusing. In fact, Hopkins wasn't even negotiating anymore.
So again, you know, what you're able to do is tell stories like this that are not really being told with the emotional depth that they deserve, in a way so that, you know, a story can be, you know, just a headline, or it can be something where you actually hear from the people themselves and it touches you in some way and you want to do something about it. That's the kind of news that I think you're trying to do and that needs to be done. Otherwise, we get into the situation, you know, just today, you know, the editor of the New York Times fired, you know, for reasons that still haven't been made clear. A lot of people suspect it had to do with wage inequities at the newspaper. You know, there are a lot of issues in the media that in a way mirror the issues in the society.
Yeah, well, certainly. In fact, just to sort of turn that on its head a bit, what we're hoping is that this building in Baltimore, the whole social dynamic, who's in it. I mean, for example, there's always been a terrible kind of what can you say, almost segregation in a sense, in the left and independent media in Baltimore and many cities across the country. You know, it's sort of friendly relations, but there's very, you know, there's black groups and there's white groups, and our building is all, one, not only is it diverse, but it's about 65-70% black, because that's what the city is. We're working very hard to be a reflection not only the demographics of the city, but we're hoping what goes on here becomes sort of a seed of what things could be, sort of a center of energy and imagination and a vision of a different kind of society.
At the same time, Real News is known for your analysis and your interviews and your information about, you know, people who are trying to challenge the dominant narratives of society. Running today on Real News, a kind of a rebroadcast of some interviews you did with Oliver Stone about the secret history of the United States. I thought we might want to just listen to a few minutes of that to give, you know, our listeners a sense of, here on Media Channel, a sense of what Real News Network does.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Baltimore. This is the beginning of a long series of interviews over the course of a year, or perhaps even more, about the TV series and the book, The Untold History of the United States. It's one of the co-authors of the script and the book. Peter Kuznick is joining us. And this is a series where you are going to get to interact with us over the course of time. What this means is I'm going to start the interview off today. We're going to begin sort of a general discussion about the history, which more or less is from the beginnings and roots of World War II onwards. And you'll be able to ask your questions and argue and debate. And Peter's agreed to come back from time to time to continue the discussion, digging in further into the history, as well as respond to anything that you, the viewer, might be raising. And he says that Oliver Stone will join us once in a while. So now, we will begin our conversation. Thanks very much for joining us, Peter.
Glad to be here.
So Peter is a professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. He's a co-writer of the 10-part Showtime series called Untold History of the United States, as I just said, and the book. So I guess we better get clear for everybody. First of all, not everybody watching this is going to be able to see the series right away, because you need to subscribe to Showtime, and I suppose maybe you should. You go watch the series, seeing as, for one reason or another, Showtime did this, and it's pretty good they did. So you might want to see it. Otherwise, the DVDs, I guess, will be out soon, but the book's available now. Let's start with, how does this whole project begin? At some point, you go to Oliver Stone and say, hey, let's do a mainstream TV series that says Stalin and the Soviet Union's not so bad.
How did you know that's how we did it? That's very prescient of you. It actually started back in 1996. When I was teaching a course, we decided we were going to do a new course at American University called Oliver Stone's America. And I was going to use Oliver's movies and then contrast his interpretations of all the events in recent U.S. history with those by people who participated in those events and by the works of scholars who the students would read. It was a course on historical interpretation. We brought in people like Robert McNamara and Dan Ellsberg and Bob Woodward and John Dean and Ron Kovic and lots of other great, great guests. And it was a very successful course, but the first time I taught in 96, Oliver heard that I was going to do it, and he said he'd be happy to come in. So we had a great session with the class, and afterwards at dinner, we went out and we were talking, and I told him, Oliver, I've got an idea for a movie you've got to make. And I laid out the story about Henry Wallace and how close Henry Wallace came to being president in 1945.
All right, let me jump in quickly. For those of you who don't know anything about the story of Henry Wallace, we interviewed Henry Wallace's grandson, and we'll put underneath this video a link to that. We'll give you a sense of Henry Wallace, but nothing the depth you're going to get by watching the series. I'm going.
Right. And I laid this out for Oliver and how that changed the course of history. And Oliver said, Peter, that's a brilliant idea. Let's do it. And I thought, you know, we're having a good time at dinner and drinking and having, you know. And so he goes back to L.A. the next day and he calls me up and he says, he's serious. Write me a treatment. I said, sure, I'd be happy to. He said, I didn't know what a treatment was. So I found out what a treatment was and I got a high-powered person to represent me and I ended up writing the script. So that was the beginning of our friendship and collaboration. We still haven't made that movie, although it's going to make a great movie when we do make it, or somebody makes it.
And just really quickly again, just so you get the significance of this if you don't know the story, and you'll find out more over the course of our interviews and if you watch this piece we did in the series, but Henry Wallace was as progressive a mainstream politician as this country ever saw.
Yes.
And becomes vice president at a critical period.
Yes.
We won't go more into that right now, but
he comes within
one can understand.
He comes within a hair's breadth, or as we would say, 5 feet.
Well, we could play more of it. It's fascinating. But I just wanted you to have a taste of what the Real News Network does. Here's an instance of a television series and a book, and here's the author, and really trying to discuss the motivations behind the work that they're doing, what their hopes were for it, how a professor becomes a screenwriter, how Oliver Stone, a famous director, collaborates with him to try to get into the issues of the untold or hidden history of the United States. And there's sort of a hidden kind of history every day, isn't there, Paul, in terms of what isn't reported in the news? I mean, it's one thing to talk about media bias. You know, it was pro, which mostly means if you're a Republican, it's pro-Democrat. If you're a Democrat, it's pro-Republican. But there's a whole layer of context and background that's missing in the news.
Well, one of the things I kind of argued with Kuznick and Stone about, and if you watch the series of interviews, while I thought they did a very important series, there's a part of it which I don't agree with, and we had several good fights about, which is the role of Roosevelt. But without getting into that in detail, just part of what comes out a little bit in their series, but more in mainstream media in general, which is this idea that the United States does bad things for good reasons, that there's fundamentally good intent behind even dropping a nuclear bomb. And one of the great things about this series is that Kuznick and Stone show how the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was, from a military point of view, completely unnecessary. And this is the beginning of the tremendous mythology that's the Cold War narrative, that America won the war because of the bomb, and I think it's now fairly well proven by their series and others. Gar Alperovitz did a book on this, and so did others, that the bomb was dropped as a shot across the bow of the Soviet Union for completely political reasons. They opened the whole door of the use of nuclear weapons. This idea that the United States, even the invasion of Iraq, the fundamental narrative now is, yes, Bush lied, but they wanted to get rid of this dictator. The Afghan war, yes, it's led to nothing, but they really wanted to get rid of the Taliban and have democracy. The narrative is we do bad things for good reasons, and the fact of the matter is it's not we making these decisions.
But this is deeply embedded, if you will, just like your videos get embedded, if you will, you know, in media practice too, where there's very little reflection or fundamental questioning of motives, and you know, there's a lot of emphasis on perception rather than, you know, reality, that Obama does something because he has to do it for the sake of appearing to be, you know, a powerful president. He can't really say what he really feels. So the people who often defend Obama say, well, he really wants to close Guantanamo, but he had to keep it open so that he would be perceived as a strong leader. And when he doesn't do things that he's, you know, that reinforce that, he becomes a weaker figure. You know, so in other words, a lot of politics seems to be almost like a kabuki theater performance. You know, it's not.
Well, I did a film before I was doing this. I was, in my background as a documentary filmmaker, I did a quite well-known movie called Hitman Hart, Wrestling with Shadows, which is about the World Wrestling Federation, which it was called at the time, Bret Hart versus Vince McMahon. And that's what politics is. Professional wrestling is you need to pretend what goes on in the ring is real. Essentially, it's theater, but it works if you believe it's real. And that's more or less the same thing with American politics. What the public sees through the media is fundamentally theater. And what we're trying to do is, we're accredited on Capitol Hill. We're going to do a lot more D.C. coverage and Washington coverage, is pull back the curtains of the theater and expose the real interests that drive U.S. politics.
So let's talk, in the time we have left, to ordinary viewers, listeners, media consumers, and the like. If you had to, you know, teach a course in civics to a group of workers in a union in Baltimore, and they were asking you, okay, Paul, how should we read the media? How should we consume it? What questions should we bring to it? What do you say?
It's all about interest. The first interest of a journalist is their own. So viewers need to remember that. The journalist begins with their own self-interest. The next interest at play is whoever owns the media organization, because the journalists, the editors, all of them, they understand through, and they, it's mostly through self-censorship, not through overt censorship, but if you want to keep your job, you keep within certain limits. Don't ever forget that when you're watching or reading the news. Understand that most media organizations, their own assumptions are so profoundly deep that the status quo is what it is. This thing we were just talking about, I had a discussion with a foreign editor of a big newspaper chain, and he would go on and on about the terrible thing that happened in Afghanistan, the terrible thing that happened in Iraq, but he could not make the connection that this is an expression of who owns stuff, who has power, and the kind of foreign policy that serves that kind of elite interest. That it's not, you know, if you want, they do bad things for bad reasons, and they do things to make money.
Why is it that the progressive movement, you know, if you go to a meeting of progressives, the first thing you hear is a great deal of bitching about the media. They don't cover this. Noam Chomsky isn't on television. It's all distorted. But when it comes to political practice, you know, they march on Washington, but not on the Washington Post. They don't really confront the media. They don't really see media as part of their political practice often, okay? And as a consequence, a lot of these media companies are let off the hook, except by the right wing that's constantly bashing them. So they try to kind of appease them by moving to the right themselves.
Yeah, it's a good question. You're going to have to ask them. we're going to do a lot more media critique, but we've been a little reticent doing too much critique until we can do way better ourselves. We're going to start doing a lot of critique, for example, as I said earlier, about how local Baltimore News covers, for example, murders. And but we're going to do it as we can do better. I mean, we're going to start with the principle, if you're going to cover murders, you need to humanize, first of all, the characters, which means the victim and the perpetrator, because the perpetrators, on the whole, are victims themselves. They're victims of, you know, a social system that you know, where there's collapsing schools and there's no opportunities and so on, and, you know, a war on drugs whose real objective was to spread drugs. So when we do those kinds of stories, we're going to do that. But should people target the mainstream media? Yeah, of course they should. It's essentially the same role the churches played under feudalism.
Well, Paul Jay, the Real News Network, a venture that is actually growing and changing and evolving and moving in a number of different directions, driven by, you know, values, driven by a perception, that people can make a difference in terms of this information war that we're all part of. So we want to wish you and your colleagues at the Real News Network all the best in this effort. To your opening of your new facility in Baltimore, to your work to try to involve people in Baltimore, more interactivity in media, more culture, and more of a connection between storytellers at the bottom and storytellers at the top. And I think you bring a lot to it. So give us the URL again for how people can tune into, zone into, and help Real News Network.
Yeah, realnews.com. And pretty soon we're going to Comcast On Demand in about 8 million houses in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. You can get us on Roku. We have a Roku channel. But the main thing right now is realnews.com. And if people are interested, the grand opening of the Baltimore building is going to be June 20th and 21st. And we're hoping we're going to see you down there, Danny.
Well, my birthday is the 27th, hint, hint. I am going to try, as part of my annual birthday commemoration, to make it there, because, you know, it was when I was there, I must say, it was one of the worst experiences. The train didn't work, this didn't work, but it was a great warm feeling of being with you and your colleagues in that building as construction went on all around us, and to see the sense of purpose and the sense of, if you will, not just idealism but political mission that animates what you're doing. And that's why I wanted you to be on mediachannel.org so that people can find out more about you. We are interviewing people from all aspects of media. I'm very happy that you were part of all of this, and we will send you the podcast of this broadcast as well, so that you can add it to your many others as people's appreciation, respect, and recognition of the work of the Real News Network increases with the efforts that you're making that are really not only visionary, but innovative in a media industry that needs it. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Paul Jay,
Paul Jay of Real News Network. Love to hear from you. Dissector at mediachannel.org. You can write to us. And please check out mediachannel.org. Danny Schechter here. See you next week.